The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, April 12th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, but rather the other heartland of America. That, of course, is the Exhibition Hall at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, Nevada. The 2019 Mass Torts Conference. On the program today, Republican senators can't work out disaster aid for Puerto Rico, so they go on vacation. Trump orphans WikiLeaks. Former Obama White House counsel indicted in charges from the Mueller fake witch hunt. Ohio bans abortion after 6 weeks in a bid to get SCOTUS to overturn Roe v. Wade. The Republicans are not on the Cain train, but they do confirm a former oil lobbyist to Secretary of Interior. All this and more on today's program. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, apologize for the late start today. We're in Las Vegas, Nevada, and just trying to gather our wits.
Nobody lost their cool, though, so that was what mattered.
Losing at the blackjack table. All this and more. Let's turn down the music, if we could. Thank you. There we go. Okay, all right, let's start right off. We will get to some of the news of the day, and I'll have a couple of interviews today. But with me now is Daniel Nye. Daniel, you're an attorney from?
Levin Papantonio. Pensacola, Florida.
Okay. And tell us this case. It's Valsartan.
Okay. It's really an interesting project because it's a lot different than a lot of the drugs we've handled in the past, which are name brand drugs, and really you start looking into corporate America greed and those kinds of things where they're putting profit over safety. This all originates with, you know, it's a generic medication, and what's happened for generics.
What is it set up to treat?
It treats high blood pressure. So the idea is, you know, one of the backstories behind this is, you know, most of our generics we've put in the hands of India and China, and with very few safeguards. And that's what we're seeing happening here in Valsartan. We've allowed 1.5 million to 2 million users a year to be taking a contaminated Valsartan pill that causes cancer.
Okay, wait a second. All right, let's back up here. So Valsartan is a generic drug, and you say it's blood pressure?
To treat high blood pressure.
Okay, and it's manufactured. Who are the American, they're manufacturing it in where?
So here's how it works. Okay. Whenever you have generic medications, the vast majority of them, they have the active ingredient, which is what makes the medication actually work, is manufactured overseas. That's manufactured in India. It's manufactured in China. The vast majority of active ingredients are manufactured overseas. And the reason for that is because they can do it a lot cheaper, and in large part because they have fewer safeguards.
All right. Well, so what? So how many different, U.S. companies, how does that get contracted out? Like, I mean, who is making Valsartan? I mean, let's start at the top of it and follow the chain of title, if you were.
Absolutely. So here's how it works. So we've got our active ingredient, and the main bad actor would be this Zhejiang Weihai facility manufacturing plant in China. They're making the active ingredient.
Who's hiring them to do that?
So then what they do is they send that pill, that contaminated active ingredient, into the U.S., and they have a U.S. subsidiary who puts it into pill form. Or there's some other people like Teva, U.S., or Actavis, you know, and some Torrent is another one of them. So some of these large companies that are U.S. manufacturers in the U.S., they take the active ingredient and they put it in pill form. And so the idea in terms of generics, you know, we've recognized that this is a problem, that we're turning over the vast majority of our drugs to China and India.
Let me, before we get there, I want to just understand. So we have a Chinese manufacturer who is basically making this active ingredient on spec.
That's right.
And then they're coming into the marketplace in the U.S. and they're saying, here, buy our active ingredient. And really, any number of different pill manufacturers at that point can say, okay, we'll take your active ingredient. They could theoretically have, I'm not in the Valsartan business, I'm in the making generic pill business.
Exactly.
And so I've got a bunch of like yeast and whey or whatever it is that I put into to make a pill.
Yes.
And I shop around for whatever the cheapest active ingredient is and say, okay, this guy's got Valsartan and there's some space in the market. So I'm just going to buy from them.
You've got it.
Put it into a pill form and then sell it. Okay, that's the way it works?
That's completely it. And so it's all about pricing. Whoever can manufacture that active ingredient for the cheapest will oftentimes win the bidding war for the U.S. manufacturers.
And so is there any, like, who oversees that marketplace of, because I presume if I'm making an active ingredient in the United States, I'm getting inspected by the FDA. Somebody must come by my factory occasionally, right?
That's right. But the problem is we don't have the adequate number of inspectors to inspect those plants. The FDA has been saying that for some time.
The plants in this country?
In China. That's right, where the active ingredient and the wrongdoing is occurring, the contamination is occurring. So the other thing that we've done is we've put safeguards to say we recognize we can't fully ensure its safety. So we say U.S. manufacturers, you have to do the testing to ensure its safety.
Because there's such a long and robust record of companies policing themselves
right.
in these instances.
That's exactly
it. It works
it.
Out so well. Okay. So, all right. So the FDA doesn't have the resources to send inspectors to these plants to make sure that the... Is there any testing of the active ingredients? At any point of the process, and how does that relate to... I mean, are there any active ingredients that are made in the United States?
Well, there are. But in terms of Valsartan, and a lot of times for generics, there's just very few of it made in the United States.
So to the extent that there's any active ingredients made in the United States, is there a process to sort of test that, like, hey, this is actually... My understanding is Las Vegas has marijuana dispensaries.
Right.
And if I go there and they put on the envelope that it has X amount of THC, presumably, like, there's somebody who comes in occasionally and tests whether that's actually the case.
That's
right?
correct. Yeah.
Do we have anything analogous for prescription drugs in this country?
We do. I mean, there's all sorts of testing that can be done. And the U.S. manufacturers will still do some random testing of these products. They did it here with Valsartan. They found signals of the contamination. They sent it back to the Chinese manufacturing plant. And you know what they did? They sent it to their local lab, and they said, we don't understand the reason for having these high testing errors, so we think it's just an error. And they repackaged it and sent it right back into the U.S.
Sort of broad understanding. So what happened, this Valsartan that was sold to, I guess, presumably multiple generic pill-making companies
That's
in the
right.
U.S.? All of those generic pill-making companies presumably have the responsibility to make sure that what they're actually buying is this active ingredient as opposed to, say, like, lead or whatever
exactly.
it is.
Exactly, yes.
And what does it turn out was in the Valsartan?
It's called NDMA or NDEA, which are nitrosamines that are very genotoxic and cause cancer.
And how did they get into this Valsartan?
So basically, when you're combining certain chemicals, and this Chinese manufacturing plant realized they could save money by changing the patent on how they combine chemicals, if they had done the simple chemistry up front I think they would have realized that there was a real high possibility of getting this NDMA and NDEA, but they didn't do the chemistry up front. And that's the problem.
So they simply changed the molecular structure of the active ingredient, and because it was a cheaper way of making it.
That's right. Well, the molecular structure is still the same tetrazole ring, but the byproduct is different because of how they combine the chemicals. And that's the byproduct is NDMA and NDEA.
And so this is in the valsartan. And so how many years has this been the case?
Well, they changed the process in 2012. And we know that active ingredient has been flowing into the U.S. at least by the end of 2014 until present. I mean, they recalled it in July of 2018.
So, and how did the recall come about?
It was a local manufacturer. I don't even think it was a U.S. manufacturer. It was a different country who realized that there was contamination. They realized this NDMA, and they called Zhejiang Weihai out, and then the EMA picked up on it, and they said, you need to recall this. And then it took the FDA multiple weeks after that to finally actually issue the recalls here in the U.S.
What's the EMA?
The European Medical Agency.
So, if I understand you correctly, there was a Chinese generic pill manufacturer, analogous to an American generic pill manufacturer, who just has all the sort of the byproducts and the stuff that it presumably makes it stick and cling into a pill, or coated to slide down your throat or whatever it is, and they're the ones who found out that the manufacturer of the active ingredient had tainted stuff. None of the American corporations who make this, they did not find this out.
Well, they may have found a signal of it, and it wasn't a Chinese company. I think it was a European country who figured it out and then flagged their European authority.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then they started to figure it out from there, and the recall started rolling thereafter.
That doesn't speak very well for the our pill manufacturers versus the European ones.
It does not.
So that gets flagged in Europe, and the FDA gets wind of it. And so what do? They start to check these pills that are coming in?
Yeah, now they've realized this is a problem. So they're vigorously checking and testing, all different batches to try to figure out if there's any NDMA or NDEA contamination. So it's no longer just the Chinese manufacturing plant that they're checking. They're checking all the facilities that are a manufacturing active ingredient for valsartan and other sartans as well.
Okay, and so who is your plaintiffs and who are the defendants in this situation?
Well, my plaintiffs are people who have been diagnosed with stomach cancer, liver cancer, colorectal cancer, or kidney cancer, because the science shows that at these high levels of NDMA contamination, it causes those cancers. So those are the people that I represent. It's unfortunate because there are many clients that I have that I'm completely convinced that it's that NDMA and their pill that caused their cancer.
And because they've been taking this for three, four years.
That's right.
Who are the defendants at this point? I mean, do you sue the U.S. manufacturers of the generic pill? Do you sue? Do you have the ability to sue the Chinese manufacturer of the actual valsartan? I mean, who gets sued here?
The people who make the active ingredient are sued, so the Chinese company is sued. But then all the U.S. manufacturers are also sued, so we sue them. And then you even have people who repackage what the U.S. manufacturer put together, so and they stick their own label on it. Well, they're also ensuring the adequacy of their drug when they do so. So those are people who also get sued. And then the other thing you got to consider is the person who actually makes the decision as to which generic a consumer is going to get is the pharmacy. And so in many states, there's distributor liability such that a pharmacy who's making that decision, they should also be ensuring the adequacy of their drug.
How would a pharmacy do that at that point? I mean, because they seem to me to be like three times removed, right, from
That's
the actual
right.
manufacturing. I mean, do most men... I guess the pharmacies must be able to track, like, this is a active ingredient made at this factory or this company. Yes? Is that?
Oh, yeah. They can tell where it's made at.
So
you can see that in the batch numbers.
So where... And so theoretically, right, there are some pharmacies that are like, we don't sell pills with active ingredients that come from X, Y, or Z countries because we don't. The FDA doesn't have the resources to really police this stuff.
That's right.
So, okay, where is this litigation now in the process, and where does it go?
So at this point, there are quite a few class action cases that have been filed where people are arguing that if we had known this was contaminated, then we would have never paid for this drug. So you don't necessarily have to be injured in order to be part of a class action. You're trying to recoup the monies that you were paying for a bad drug.
Right.
So we have those cases filed, but we also have quite a few personal injury cases, and they've been consolidated. All the personal injury cases and class action cases have been consolidated. They're being handled in front of Judge Kugler and Judge Schneider in the District of New Jersey.
And so that's, again, a multi-district litigation, right? And
that's correct.
In New Jersey. And how do you pick that venue, New Jersey? I mean, what, or is that just...
It's the responsibility of a panel of federal judges. It's called the JPML. And it's their job to figure out which federal jurisdiction would be suitable for a case like this. And so, you know, Judge Kugler and Judge Schneider were a good fit for this case because they handled Benicar, which is also known as Olmesartan. So they already had some background understanding of this class of medications.
Interesting. So that's the way that some venues are picked. And does it have any implications when it's all federal? We're all federal courts here, right? So
that's right.
It doesn't. The jurisdiction is less relevant. I mean, obviously for travel and issues like that, but the jurisdiction is less relevant. It's more specifically who the judges are, and those judges are picked by a panel based on maybe issues like they have understanding of this sort of type of litigation in this type of product.
That's right. And obviously what's going to drive a lot of it is their availability. They want to be making sure there's an even spread of cases amongst different litigations, and also that it's a convenient forum for the attorneys to be able to get to.
Is there any, are there heightened levels of responsibility for, in terms of how you collect damages from, let's say, the manufacturer of the pill versus the manufacturer of the active ingredient? Are there, because there's like more, I guess, U.S. obligations maybe on the manufacturer of the pill, are there heightened liabilities there, or is liability shared across all sort of classes of people involved in it?
Well, that's a great question, and the buck stops at the U.S. manufacturer. I mean, it's their job. In terms of generics, we've recognized, obviously, they're the Chinese company, they're bad actors. There's a very high standard in terms of what these U.S. manufacturers require to do. And the liability standard is strict liability, such that if there's cancer in a pill, it doesn't matter if you did something wrong or not. You're liable for it.
Right. And they clearly don't have terribly strict testing regimes for this stuff.
That's right. And just to be clear, we do think they did something wrong on top of it, obviously. But the standard is so high that if there's cancer in a pill, you're strictly liable for it.
So now, do you go into discovery and try and find evidence that they had inklings about this and just didn't press too hard and thought they could just sort of make it somebody else's responsibility?
That's correct. And we've already felt like with some of the 438, those are the inspection reports that we've already been able to uncover. We've already have some of that information that we believe these manufacturers in the U.S. should have been on notice of this problem.
Oy. Horrible. And how many plaintiffs are we talking about? I mean, how many people, has there been any type of like epidemiology studies that give us a sense of how many people we're talking about? I mean, how many people take this drug or did during those years? And how many, do we have a sense of how many are suffering from cancer?
That's a good question. So we estimate that there are approximately 1.5 to 2 million people who were taking contaminated Valsartan each year between 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018. Mm-hmm. Now, some of those are the same people taking them throughout all those years. In fact, a lot of them are taking them for those years. The FDA came out early on and they said that the incident rate was 1 in 8,000, that 1 in 8,000 people would be expected to get cancer. But we've looked into this and we just think they're absolutely wrong, and that incident rate is much higher than the 1 in 8,000. And we've looked at meta-analyses of gastric cancer, for example, and we just think they're utilizing the wrong formula as to how they come up with that 1 in 8,000.
Who develops that formula? Is that internal development, or do they farm that out to the companies too?
Well, no, I think, and we're not sure. Maybe they do farm it out. That's a good question. But I know that the information first came out of EMA, so it might have been the European Medical Agency, and then the FDA basically adopted the same reasoning, and then we saw Health Canada adopt the same thing. But that was all early on. I don't think they're speaking to incident rate now, because I think they recognize the problem, that it's very possibly a much higher incident rate, but they can't tell people that because they've already received 40,000 calls from the FDA agency. I mean, if they start telling people how high the incident rate is, I don't think they'd be able to handle the blowback.
Okay. All right. Lastly, so how long does this litigation stretch out? Do you have a notion?
Well, I mean, we got a pretty good example in Benicar. The judges that are overseeing this litigation, they're efficient. And, you know, we don't know how long this one will last because you don't necessarily know what the information that's going to be discovered or what the experts are going to testify this early on. But oftentimes you'll see somewhere in the process between 2 years for a shorter litigation, sometimes as long as 5 years for some of the longer litigations.
Well, Daniel and I, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
Thanks for coming on.
Appreciate it.
All right. And we have another attorney coming from Levin Papantonio. If we could just let... there you go. That was not the most horrific. So sitting with me now is Archie Lamb. Archie, you are also an attorney with Levin Papantonio, is that right?
I am. I'm of counsel with Levin Papantonio.
And you're working on some cases that came out of the California fires.
Well, yeah. You know, there are so many California wildfires, it's hard to really keep up. This is the Woolsey Fire. This fire started at Chatsworth Station in Ventura County, right on the L.A. County-Ventura County border. It's not the Pacific Gas and Electric cases in Northern California. This is Southern California Edison, a different public utility. But on their property, it occurred. So that's the genesis of the case.
Okay, so the fire starts. Give us a sense of what the implications of the fire were. How many people impacted, homes, if there were any lives lost. Just give us a sense of what happened.
So what happened in this fire on November the 8th of last year, 2018, there had been a couple of days of really dangerous high winds, Santa Ana winds, as I'm sure you're familiar with, that caused the utility to be concerned and the municipal authorities to be concerned that the power lines may be subject to oscillating and contact and causing an arc, which is a known occurrence. So for some reason, even though there was a warning issued 2 days earlier, the power company decided not to disconnect the power to that particular substation.
Why would they make that conscious decision?
You should take the first deposition, because that is the very first question we're going to want to know. And by the way, California Fire, the state agency responsible for investigating, is doing exactly that investigation. And in the Thomas Fire, which is about a year earlier, occurred just north of where the Woolsey Fire occurred, Cal Fire decided that Southern Cal Edison was responsible for the occurrence. We're confident that based on our initial investigation and some videos that they're going to find the same thing in the Woolsey Fire.
So, okay. So they have an obligation to just, there's some basic protocols that they, for whatever reason, didn't follow. And as you get into discovery, you find these things out, maybe somebody didn't want to lose the extra day or two of energy that they'd be providing, and that cuts into their profits. Or maybe it's just they had cut back on the number of personnel, and so they don't have enough people to actually pay attention to these things the way they should. What were the implications? How many people lost their homes? I mean, how big of a fire was this?
And this fire started on November the 8th, 2018. Lasted for about two really strong days, day and a half. Wasn't really extinguished till the 14th. So November the 8th to the 12th, I'm sorry, not the 14th. But the point is, 100,000 acres, 1,500 structures were destroyed.
1,500
destroyed structures.
So it's a
homes, restaurants,
oh geez,
apartment buildings were destroyed. 250,000 people were displaced, and so many. You know, one of our first clients was Christie's Roadhouse, right on Canaan Canyon Road. All the people that worked there lost their jobs. And so there are lots of different levels of injury. Losing your home, losing your possessions, losing the place you work. We have a client that had a huge landscaping business, lost all of his trucks, all of his equipment. Gentleman owns a winery, lost all of his inventory, if you will, lost his entire crop. And so these people are at zero. Ground zero, and have to literally rebuild not just the physical facilities but their lives.
And so it's not just a question of not shutting down that power station. What happened with that power station itself? I mean, how did that lead to the fire?
Okay, so 2:22 in the afternoon of November the 8th, an arc occurs, and there's an obligation of the public utility
What does an arc mean?
When the wires touch, it causes a reaction in the internal monitoring system of the power source. And any abnormal behavior, they're required by law to report. So the report comes in at 2:22. Ironically and fortuitously, frankly, at 2:24, 2 minutes later, a television helicopter from L.A. was headed up to the campfire site, the Northern California site where everyone died, to take video, and they got a video of two fires on either side of the Chatsworth substation 2 minutes after the arc.
Wow, okay. So they the signal comes through their internal system like red flag, and this helicopter flies over and sees actual fire in the substation. And what do they do? What does the news team do?
The news team reports it to the 911, and it gets reported. But remember, these are the canyons, and I know you know between Westlake Village and Calabasas on the 101, you go through the canyons and what they call over the hill to Malibu, and it's curvy, windy,
right,
rocky, and so it was to some extent a really difficult accessibility issue. Also, at that time, the Malibu Fire Department were up assisting in the campfire cases in Northern California.
Wow. So they had less resources.
They had less resources, and this is a fire that was relatively small in the beginning, but it became a predator. It ran from several miles north of the 101, hopped the 101, and ran all the way through those canyons, 100,000 acres, Sam.
Wow.
All the way to the sea.
And so once that fire was ignited, now, I mean, I presume, like, so there's, so in this case, the electric company failed to just take the normal procedures that you would anticipate and that their own protocols would call for in anticipation of high winds like this. There is direct evidence that what one would anticipate could happen because of that wind happened, and the evidence was not only that they got the red flag through their system, but there was literally a helicopter that saw the fire start where it would start relative to that red flag.
Yeah, so it's sort of a dichotomy analysis. So since 1993, Southern Cal Edison has been fined and punished at least 7 or 8 times for failure to take reasonable care to do everything they could to prevent this type of event. couple of different things. They did an analysis that decided 20 years ago or so that they should have buried the lines. Too expensive. They decided not to. Another part of the problem is the debris and buildup in and around the common areas of this part of California created a tinderbox, really, of potential damage. All of these things the power company knew. And under California law, there is strict liability. In other words, there's no question that if a fire starts in a public utility facility, they, the public utility, are responsible for the property damage of the homeowner, business owner that is damaged to whatever extent that property damage exists. Strict liability. The next level, and this is what you're talking about, and I don't want to be presumptuous. We believe in good faith that there are additional things that they knew and could have done and should have done, but that's part of our obligation to prove. But then that goes to the level of negligence or maybe worse.
Right.
And so that's what the litigation is about. Because if you get the negligence or worse, you get to the damages over and above property damage, pain and suffering, mental anguish, the post-traumatic stress disorder that is so palpable, so real in the eyes of these people who have 15-year-old, 17-year-old kids who will never again go to their school, never again be in that idyllic home that they had, that lifestyle with their friends. They're displaced. Those are real damages that if there is another level of misconduct or failure to act as they should have, these people would be entitled to.
You know, one of the things I know from upstate New York, there's been a lot of consolidation really across like the Northeast in terms of the electric and gas companies. And what everybody says up there is it used to be that Niagara Mohawk, which was the company that ended up getting swallowed into National Grid, Niagara Mohawk would come by and they would regularly cut the trees around the power lines. And they would do all sorts of precautionary measures. And once National Grid came in, you would never see anybody doing that unless there was some type of special call or there was some type of other thing. And I mean, it feels like this is a similar type of dynamic where it's just like we've done a cost-benefit analysis. We can get away with this. And how much of a responsibility when they start to cut those corners and they know that the incidence and intensity of these fires in California is increasing because of climate change, like how much responsibility do they have on that end of it? Like, because not only are they cutting back their responsibilities, but it's well known that the risk is increasing. Like, how much more responsibility do they have under that formula?
So the cornerstone of your question is you're asking me to assume that climate change is not fake news?
Well, yes.
Okay. All right. So, you know what's really tragically hilarious is that's part of what that whole notion of ignoring climate change is, so that they can avoid the liability associated with that pre-fire knowledge of the reality of what's happening in that space, over which they are responsible and obligated by federal and state statutes to avoid. It's reasonable care. They have a reasonable duty to prevent those things that they know or should have known are likely to be this combustible predator fire. We know they're coming again. It's going to happen in California because the Santa Ana winds, because the power lines are exposed, because the winds are 80 to 100 miles an hour. This stuff is going to happen. The debris that is wood that starts the and brush that's dry,
right,
with that arid climate, you know, it's they can't avoid knowing that they ought to clean it up, certainly around the substation, to reduce the likelihood of a fast-moving fire, which this was.
How many of these fires are a function of these power stations? Because I feel like every time there's like one person who had a campfire that turned into a massive fire, or a homeless person who was living, you know, in an area and lit a fire. Like, I hear about that, but you just don't hear so much, it seems to me. And maybe it's just I'm not in California. It doesn't get the same level of reporting, I guess.
Well, here's what I'll tell you. After 30-plus years of practicing law, every person that gets hit by a railroad train at a crossing that doesn't have gates and lights was trying to beat the train, is what right. the railroad says. Every time there's a plane crash, it's always the pilot's error, never a manufacturing defect. Every time there's a fire, it's an arsonist at the root of it all. And the fact of the matter, is sometimes that's true.
Right.
But it's incumbent on us as lawyers to make that assessment independently on behalf of the people who've lost their homes, their lives, their livelihood, their dream, to determine, is this truly Southern Cal Edison's fault? And if so, access the courts to achieve justice for those people and not let the rumor mongers defending this obligation these corporate folks have to pay for the sins, to hold them accountable. And that's what this battle is all about.
Well, Archie Lamb, thank you so much for your time today. Really interesting stuff.
Always good to be with you, Sam. Thank you.
All right. Appreciate it. All right, folks. And back in Brooklyn, we're going to run an interview I did yesterday with Andy Betterman. He is the chair of the AAJ Political Action Committee. And what this guy does is basically work on legislation, fight legislation, that would inhibit the ability of lawyers like we've talked to today, for instance, and yesterday, to bring these cases. And it gives you a good general overview of what's going on here. Matt, are you ready to run that?
Yep, ready to go.
All right, let's run that, and then we'll come back with more. We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report, broadcasting live from Las Vegas, Nevada, for the 2019 Mass Torts Conference. Joining me now is Andy Betterman. He is the chair of the AAJ Political Action Committee, PAC, also an attorney from the Washington, D.C. area, I guess. So, Andy, first off, let's start with what is the AAJ?
Okay, AAJ is the National Trial Lawyers Association organization. It's basically the National Bar Association, if you will, of civil trial lawyers who represent plaintiffs in their claims for compensation for all manner of injury, but especially personal injury against individuals, corporations, government, and so on. So AAJ stands for the American Association for Justice. That's what AAJ is. I'm the volunteer chair of the Political Action Committee, and like most organizations in America, we also have a Political Action Committee, which is the only nonpartisan Political Action Committee in the United States dedicated to the preservation of the civil justice system. In other words, we keep the courthouse doors open for every American.
Right, and you know, that's one of the themes, obviously, of why I've been coming here, is because of that function. Like, why is that important? You know, what does that mean? The courthouse doors open. Let's just start with why that's important, and then we'll get to the ways that that metaphorical door is sort of shut.
It's very important because the founders of our country contemplated, and in fact designed, a system in which every citizen had equal access to the courts and to the rule of law, regardless of their financial position in life. And that's what we do. I mean, when I say we keep the courthouse doors open, plaintiffs' lawyers like myself and those in AAJ do not charge a fee when a client hires us. We are paid on what's called a contingent fee basis, which means we get paid if and when the case resolves favorably for our client. And that, to me, is the great leveler, because it used to be that people thought they'd have to have thousands of dollars to pay a retainer to an attorney to get legal representation. With a contingent fee, which has been around at least 50 years, if not longer. You don't need that. All you need is a meritorious case and an attorney who's willing to take it, and you'll have access to the courts just like ExxonMobil, just like AT&T.
And, okay, so how does the doors, these metaphorical doors, how do they get shut?
That's a good question. They get shut, for the most part, legislatively. And there's been an effort, again, throughout my 40 years at the bar, been an effort by business and industry to do just that by legislation. So to give you an example, a common law that's passed, has been passed in many states, but not yet federally, is a cap on damages, which has been advocated for a generation by business and industry. And a cap on damages does just that. It places a limit on the amount of money a victim can recover for what's called non-economic loss, which is injury to your injury and your pain and suffering. So, for instance, in a state like Maryland, where I practice, we have a cap that 30 years ago, you know, was under $100,000 and has been escalated to about $1 million. But we still have a cap. Some states have caps that are $250,000. So I've had cases where people have been horribly burned, and the most that they can recover for their injury, not for their economic loss, medical expenses, lost wages, and have you, but the most they can recover for their injury and their scar, if you will, is about $1 million, when the case is worth far more than that.
And so, you know, and we have many examples. You know, people can go back and listen to the probably at this point dozens of interviews I've done with attorneys here.
Yes.
Where corporations will cut corners. Almost that's best case scenario when we're talking about these cases. They'll cut corners and think they can think it won't be a problem. The certain amount of negligence. There's also cases where, like, they know this product is going to hurt people, but they've invested too much in the marketing. They've invested too much in the development. They need to, you know, they need to create shareholder value. They go forward and they make a calculation.
Yes, they do.
We may have to pay out X amount of dollars.
Yes, they do.
But that's going to be 10%, 5%, 2%,
right,
maybe 25% of our profits.
Mm-hmm.
And so caps at that point do two things, right?
Right.
One, it basically... it makes it less viable for an attorney to bring the case because you need an enormous amount of money to fight an Exxon or a DuPont or whatever it is. So you need to have built a war chest or gotten a line of credit or whatnot.
Right.
And it also undercuts the functioning of civil litigation as a sort of second order regulation.
Yes.
Right? It doesn't inhibit as a deterrent.
Yes.
And so that's why caps exist on some level. So there is no deterrent to this type of behavior.
Right. And in fact, a cap in many cases is a disincentive to the corporation or whoever the defendant is, the person or the corporation that you've made claim against. It's a disincentive to them to settle because they know that they go to trial and a jury finds for the plaintiff and is empathetic to the plaintiff and awards a lot of money, that most of it will be taken away to the extent that the award exceeds the cap. So it's really a disincentive to them to roll the dice. In states where there aren't caps, then you'll find that many defendants come to the settlement table much more readily and freely than they do in states where there are caps.
Does the AAJA PAC, do you work on this on a state level, or is it strictly federal?
That's a good question. We raise money for federal races, for the Congress, the House, the Senate, and the presidency. So we help identify candidates who share our views about the court system, about equal access to the courts, and then we help them win election to office. And if they do, then we know where they stand on our issues.
Right.
We know where they stand on our issues. In the last election, we raised over $6 million. We supported 299 candidates for office. 85% of them won election. And we were instrumental in the election of the 40 members of the House, the 40 seats in the House that flipped from the GOP to the Democrats and hence placed Speaker Pelosi in the Speaker's chair and removed Speaker Ryan from the chair.
Now, Andy, I know you're a nonpartisan group. I'm going to guess, though, that Democrats tend to share your perspective more than Republicans.
We are a nonpartisan group, but practically speaking, most of the candidates that we support are members of the Democratic Party. There are some Republicans who share our views, and if there are, then we gladly support them. Give you an example. Senator Lindsey Graham is a great friend of the court system. Now, I've got nothing in common with him.
Right.
And I really, and in no way do I support him, but he is a senator from South Carolina. He's not going anywhere, but he has a guaranteed vote for us because he used to be a trial lawyer, and he understands the system and shares our views.
What has been the most significant threat to the ability to bring cases in recent years? Has it been legislation? Has it been executive action? Or has it been, frankly, just a judiciary that has been, seems to me, close to overwhelmed by conservative justice?
Yeah. Judges. I think it's legislation myself. I mean, judges will be judges. They'll make decisions, and they have tremendous power in our system. Executive orders, less so. Legislation, I mean, AAJ, which maintains a lobby staff as well, last year dealt with, in the last session of Congress, addressed over 700 tort reform, 700 measures designed to close the courthouse doors, if you will. All right, one of them seeks to impose a $250,000 national cap on non-economic or pain and suffering damages, regulate attorney's fees, which would then basically be a disincentive to attorneys to take cases if they can't make what they need to make when the case resolves to justify the investment of their time and money in a case. There was a bill in the last session. I mean, the most salient ones were the one to impose a national cap, regulate attorney's fees, and that would apply to medical malpractice, nursing home, and pharmaceutical or bad drug and bad medical device cases. There was a bill to make it, most of these cases are filed in sort of like a class action. It's not. It's called an MDL. But there was a bill that would make, basically, mandate that within 45 days of filing your case, you have to file with the court proof that you're going to win without the benefit of civil discovery or information exchange. And so that's virtually impossible to do.
So these multi-district litigation cases, so that's where, and we were talking to someone on yesterday's program about a case involving 3M's
earplugs
that they sold to the military. There are cases of damages, probably, of military personnel all across the country.
Yes.
Instead of all those issues being litigated in each state, they're wrapped up in federal court, and they're actually going to be tried in Pensacola.
Right.
In this instance, they could end up in any jurisdiction. I have two questions on that legislation. So one is that if you could prove the case in 45 days, why wouldn't you just prove the case in 45 days?
Because you can't, because as you know, in our system of civil litigation, right, the plaintiff files a complaint, the defendant files an answer. Then you begin what's really a beautiful process called civil discovery. And the purpose of that is to literally allow each side to actually discover the other side's evidence. And there are a number of tools, written questions, document production requests, and depositions, which you've seen on, many of your listeners have probably seen on television.
Right.
You know, where the witness is sworn under oath and is asked questions by the other attorney, right? And that's a lengthy process, and particularly in complex civil cases against large corporations. It takes months, if not years, to complete discovery. And typically, at the end of discovery, then, if the other side feels that it's not liable, it's going to file a motion to dismiss, right, which the judge then decides. Under this measure, which has not become law, right, you would have to, a lawyer who files a case would have to file prima facie proof, which is about 51%, right, that the defendant is liable within 45 days of filing. And that's virtually impossible.
I mean...
You know, so it's another way to close the doors.
Right.
To eliminate plaintiffs, and slam the door shut.
So, and would that legislation basically say that there should not be discovery, essentially? Or does
it
contemplate that discovery? Right, okay, because, and people should understand that what a company, you know, and just for example, Mike Papantonio, who from Levin Papantonio, obviously used to do Ring of Fire with me and occasionally still hops on. Maybe we can get him this week here, but... he does a case against DuPont over the C8, and they basically back up an 18-wheeler with millions of pages of documents and say, good luck. And, you know, it comes from a firm that's a big firm that has a lot of money, has a lot of resources, has a lot of staff, and they actually went through the documents and found documents that even the 3M lawyers didn't realize were there, and right. That's how this guy wins the case. The idea that you could do that process in 45 days is absolutely absurd.
It's virtually impossible.
Okay, so
it's impossible.
So clearly that you know, that's basically a poison pill for why specifically MDLs? Why multiple?
Because that's the venue. That's where all the bad drug cases and the medical device cases end up. I mean, they're all. It's really. I mean, an MDL is a tool that the court system has to make it easier to handle large numbers of cases. It's like a class action. And in a class action, each victim has to have the same, each victim had to suffer the same injury as a result of the same act by the same defendant, right? And if you are such a victim and a class is filed and you can opt into the class and you can get your share of whatever the ultimate award is without having to litigate your case. And the reason that the class actions are not used in bad drug cases is because in bad drug cases there may be common liability among all the defendants. In other words, the same evidence that proves the defendant's liable to you would prove the defendant's liable to me, but the victims have different injuries.
Okay.
Of so varying degrees.
I take a medicine that's been tainted with jet fuel,
yes.
Let's say, to use an example that we may end up having a conversation about while we're here. And the company that produced that that medicine did the same act that got that medicine into your bottle and my bottle.
Right.
But for me, it gives me colon cancer.
Right.
For you, it gives you,
gives me a headache.
Gives you a headache, but it gives you maybe
yes.
some type of like colitis.
A different injury.
Right.
Different injury.
And so there's, and that's when you would need a multi-district litigation.
Right. In a multi-district case, which really is where all of the cases that we talk about at this conference end up, virtually all of them, end up in a multi-district litigation, then you have the liability issue, which is common to all the victims, is handled commonly and once for the benefit of all the victims, right? But the injury part of the claim is, obviously they're different from, they vary from victim to victim, and they have to be handled individually.
And so they set up basically an algorithm, right?
If the case resolves, they set up a master, a matrix, if you will, that's used to determine who's entitled to compensation and to what extent. But this measure, which was introduced in the Congress, right, which was probably hatched at Big Pharma or the Chamber of Commerce or both, right, would essentially close that door. Because no one can really produce prima facie proof in 45 days.
Right,
it's impossible.
Absurd. What's the biggest piece of legislation that has actually passed? Has there been any?
No, there really hasn't. And I have to say, largely because of
mostly on state levels
yes.
where we see this, right?
But federally, right? Federally, there's been very little significant tort reform legislation in the last decade, and it's largely because of AAJ. Now, I would say the most damaging thing. I mean, there was a court decision about mandatory arbitration.
Right. Was that
right.
Concepcion and AT&T, or is
I
that
think so,
a?
Yeah. I believe so. And we're fighting to. Overrule that legislatively. That's probably the biggest bad thing that's happened is forced arbitration. But none of these other measures have passed. There's no national cap. The court system, the courthouse doors are still open, right? There are still MDLs, but there's a lot of time and energy and money that's been invested and will continue to be invested by business in America to close those doors. And it's a drumbeat that I've been hearing. I've been practicing law since 1978, and I've been hearing this nonstop since then.
And they've used many tactics, ranging from like taking a story. You know, I don't know, maybe it was 4 or 5 years ago now. I had a documentary filmmaker on who was here, who had done a documentary on the famous hot coffee case from McDonald's,
right?
Which was lampooned in the, but it turned out she. Like, when people hear the details of it's pretty nuts.
Yes.
And that's been an ongoing... I mean, what does AAJ do in terms of, like, from a cultural perspective, right? Because there's, there's theories out there that legislation and politics are downstream from culture.
Yes.
Trial lawyers, I mean, you call yourself a plaintiff attorney.
Right.
You know, because trial lawyers have been maligned, and it's a...
unfairly.
I couldn't agree more, but there was a specific agenda behind that.
Right. So the best that we, what we do is educate as best we can. And we tell our members, you know, AAJ is sort of the mother organization of all the state trial lawyer associations. Each state has one. And AAJ is sort of the mothership, if you will. And we work closely with the state organizations. And for, you know, for a long time, we've been trying to educate people on the state level. But the best education is for when a doubter is suddenly a victim.
Right. Well,
you know, and once a doubter is a victim, then the doubter looks at things dramatically differently. President Trump, for instance, you know, I was just speaking in the session there about the work of the PAC, and I always talk about President Trump, who loves to litigate when it suits his needs.
Right.
When it doesn't suit his needs, he hates lawyers, hates the court system. So, but he's an example of a guy who knows that when the doors are open for an individual, and that individual needs him open, it's good.
What would you say, do you have a sense of which state is the most hostile to civil litigation?
There are a number of states that have $250,000 caps. I can't tell you the names right now. They tend to be states, I mean, the states that are more hostile tend to be more rural.
Right.
With smaller populations and a history of real conservatism. Although, interestingly, I mean, you had a state like Arizona where the right to, you know, there was a cap there that was held invalid by the state's high court because it contradicted the state's constitution, which guarantees everybody equal access to the courts.
Interesting.
That's unusual for that state, which has a history of conservatism.
And that's a good dynamic that the court would interpret. I mean, it's almost like a poll tax, right?
Yes.
In some respects, as applied to the opportunity to have recourse in civil litigation. All right. Well, so let me just ask you this. I'm curious. You've been practicing since 1978. Has the behavior of corporate America changed significantly during that time, or has this been? Is this a consistent animal that essentially each new endeavor? There's going to be a certain percentage of them that are willing to cut corners or to just nakedly ignore evidence that they have and are aware of that their product could be damaging, for example. Has that changed at all, one
yes
way or another?
Yes and yes. It's I think change on a national level is an incremental, slow process, just like legislation is. But I think some corporations have changed their behavior, but I think the vast majority have not. And what a corporation might have to pay victims, right, because of the failure of a product, really hasn't changed at all. I think it just remains an economic calculation for them, especially in the pharmaceutical industry, you know, where the development costs are high, understandably. I just think they factored in, that's all. They know a certain number of people are going to, you know, bottom line is they've invested so much money in the development of a product that they're going to do whatever they can do to keep that product on the market. And if they know or should know that there's going to be a problem with the product, they're just going to factor the cost of that in into the cost of the product. That's simple. So things haven't changed that much, in my opinion. What has changed is the frequency with which they have to... with which they're called to account and ultimately have to pay. I think that's changed dramatically.
Has that gotten up?
I think it's increased, yes. I think you see it a lot more.
Is that because of just the level of sophistication of
because of the plaintiff's
terms?
Because of the plaintiff's bar. Because of what plaintiff's trial lawyers do. You know, we keep America safe, and if it's not safe, we keep the courthouse doors open for you.
Well, Andrew Betterman, the director, their chair, I should say, of the AAJ Political Action Committee, thanks so much for your time
today.
Thank you
for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, folks. That's it for the legal portion of our show. post-legal portion next. We're going to head into the fun half, I think. I should just say, though, you know, it's funny. I ran into, yesterday during the broadcast, a guy walked by in this, and, you know, I'm in like an exhibition hall. There's just booths that provide support for attorneys, essentially, all sorts of different type of things. Like these firms need loans to finance their cases. I was talking to a couple of people about, and the drug escapes me, so I'm not going to say the name of it because these drug names are insane. But apparently there was a drug that was given to adults as perhaps, I think it was an antipsychotic. I'm not 100% sure. And they started to give it to children without doing any tests on children. And it turned out that boys who were taking it, who would go through puberty, would develop large breasts. So significantly large that some of them started to lactate. And there had never been any testing on this drug on children. And there were a lot of cases that were started. And what the manufacturer of the drug did was simply just string it out long enough, knowing that a lot of these cases were held by small practitioners. They'd all taken out loans to finance the case, right? Because you don't get paid until you get, you don't get paid unless you win and until you win. And so all of these small practitioners are taking out the loans, and they basically all had to drop out because after a while, the debt burden became too intense for them. And so these kids who took these drugs, who are already obviously going through difficult times, that's why you're on a drug like that, had to go through high school with, you know, 13-year-old boy, going through high school with, you know, extended breasts. And there was no real accounting for this stuff.
You need another reason to abolish capitalism.
And so, you know, it's interesting. There's all sorts of sort of like strange, you know, you know, business services that are here. And, you know, that's just one of them. Then there's other things like where they do intake of clients and all sorts of different things here. So anyways, I'm here at the desk doing my thing, and I see a guy walks up to the table, a guy I know, and I don't want to reveal too much because I don't know how much he wants to be identified. Maybe he will. I was hoping he would be around here so I could actually talk to him because he's got a very interesting background that would be interest of people here, but I'm not sure he'd want to talk about it. But the guy is sort of libertarian leaning. He's like one of the, I wouldn't call him a full hardcore libertarian, but he's sort of libertarian leaning. And he is here working on a startup with some of these cases, specifically the one that I talked about that drug that was given to 13-year-old kids. In fact, he and his partner, you know, told me those stories. And they found these old dockets, and they're trying to revive them in some way. Anyways, he's working on this startup. And he and his buddies from Texas, libertarian types, were very, very skeptical of this from an ideological perspective, because trial lawyers have been demonized for years, and with very specific intent by places like the Chamber of Commerce and whatnot, because these people go after big corporations. And they both cited the story of the hot coffee from McDonald's. Now, longtime listeners will remember on this program, maybe it was 5 or 6 years ago, we interviewed, I had multiple interviews with the documentary filmmaker who had gone back and made a movie called Hot Coffee about that case. And people my age certainly remember hearing about this, and it was a way to bash trial lawyers. This idea that some woman is suing McDonald's because her coffee was so hot and she got burned a little bit and, you know, was suing them for a ton of money. Exactly. And this is what's wrong with America. People don't take personal responsibility. And if you look into that case, and if you have the opportunity to see that movie, definitely worth seeing the movie. But if you look into that case, you find out that you're talking about an elderly woman who got the coffee. The coffee was kept at a temperature that was exceedingly high because it saved McDonald's, because they had done, you know, the they had run their quantitative, you know, some type of like McNamara-esque efficiency thing, and they found that if they kept the coffee at like 112 degrees, they could make more coffees and backlog them, save, you know, 12 cents an hour or something like that. So the coffee she got, the cup literally disintegrated, and it spilt into her crotch. She's an elderly woman. She needed reconstructive surgery. All she would had asked from McDonald's was help with the surgery, and they wouldn't do it.
Well, shouldn't she have done research on the coffee before she went there?
Yeah, and the
right.
cups?
As a responsible right. consumer.
You bring your own cup or you check out the cups.
Yeah, I mean, she could have brought her own cup. I just think we need to live in more of a responsibility society.
That's a user problem.
And the and so in the end, she was just doing this because at first I think it was like they won't even apologize. And then ultimately through discovery, they found like this was by design to have the coffee that hot. And they changed their practices because of it, because of the lawsuit. But the general public used it for years. I mean, any time, and I can't remember what, like, if this was in the 90s, I suspect it was.
I remember it from childhood.
Yeah, yeah. I also have a memory of people making fun of that lady.
So it must have been in the 90s. And I mean, I just remember Rush Limbaugh. I mean, that was like... You would just toss that off as an example of why lawyers are horrific. And so, and I was talking to these two guys who were recent converts to, you know, understanding the sort of this dynamic. And I haven't caught up with my buddy, but I wonder if it hasn't, in some respects, begun to undercut his ideology on some level. But,
I'd like to call it a libertarian perspective. Can't really hear you.
We will give them an opportunity to do so.
I feel my concern is, I mean, okay, so is there a reason why she couldn't have called maybe like the CEO? Yeah, I can't really hear. But maybe she could have called the head of McDonald's and said, maybe we could work this out instead of trying to force the CEO to pay her in a compulsory manner. It could have been more free that way.
See, we didn't even need to figure out the phones. Michael can play every caller.
There you go.
Why don't you sue who made her underwear instead?
But maybe, no, don't, because then the underwear maker gets drawn. Yeah. I just feel like she could have just said, like, hey, like, look, like, maybe we could go and I could roll up my sleeves and you could roll up your sleeves and we could just kind of, you know, like, talk this out. I don't know.
You know, the... It was interesting what Archie Lamb was saying about climate change, because the literally, I think yesterday in hearings, The head of the EPA said that climate change not the not their top priority. Just not gonna.
It's not doing it.
What the not hell gonna. Is wrong with people?
Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent, Archie Lamb, you know, pointed out that not only would an acknowledgement of man-made climate change force our the hands of fossil fuel companies, but it would also start to create sort of benchmarks. Like, okay, you're aware of another threat that exists out there, right? Like, we all know that you shouldn't have people walk across a busy highway. That's an existing, that's a danger. Once it becomes codified that the science, and once there is broad acceptance of the science of climate change, that puts obligations on all sorts of different industries and to respond to this and to acknowledge it and then to start to behave and change their behavior to comport with that acknowledged risk.
If we do something about climate change, then all of a sudden we might have to worry about our ingredients and other things.
That's right.
I mean, where does this end?
There is also, and I don't want to unleash the great Monsanto wars of 2013 or whatever it was.
I do. Grow up. But Monsanto's a bad company, and stop with your stop it. Nerdery and don't ever call.
There is increasing evidence that that Roundup is carcinogenic.
Oh my God, I can't believe you're saying that. You're going to destroy the whole biotech research. I want to argue about that for 45 minutes and send obsessive emails.
If there's one thing these major companies need, it's for people to like stand for them and reply.
Yeah, you know what Monsanto and Bayer, which actually acquired Monsanto recently, is to make it one of like the most... And Bayer, I believe... I think Bayer has been covered at the Torts conference.
Oh, my God.
Things, right?
In fact, I had a conversation with another doctor who was telling me about a supplement that that you take to diminish inflammation. And apparently inflammation is in many different forms in our body is highly problematic, right? And in fact, everything from like PTSD is a function of inflammation in the brain, and he is a sports doctor, of top athletes in the country, and has done a lot of work with folks from special ops who have problems. And he said, we've known for 25 years, science has known, Harvard Research Facility found that there was a vitamin, and I get a or some type of supplement that would deal with inflammation, and it would deal with inflammation in such a way that it allowed the body to recover from the inflammation. But Bayer found that, used their aspirin to function in the same way, except for it doesn't necessarily allow the body to recover from inflammation in the same way, and also can cause some stomach issues.
Now kids won't take their vitamins. No, why are you talking about this?
So what happened is Bayer bought the patent for this drug or supplement and sat on it for 25 years. Basically took it out of the marketplace because it didn't want it competing against it. And it just came off patent about 5 years ago or something, and Harvard bought it back. And they're now starting to do all sorts of research with this and finding that it's how potentially effective it could be in for a whole host of issues. But people just don't understand the depths of corporate behavior that is driven by profits. And so, things like buying the patent of a drug that you know is more effective than your drug and then sitting on it for 25 years, that is just simply called business.
But we should let these companies patent things like seeds and other forms of essential
and
to
parts
the entire
of the genome.
Parts of the genome and things essential to the global food supply. Because if we don't, then obscure research projects at universities that none of us are talking about will be implicated.
But
I welcome your dumb calls.
I guess, but and the point is that for those people who believe in the efficacy of the market, you are completely deluding yourself as to the intentions and the incentive structure that exists for big players in the market. It does not, like, the amount of innovation that has been stifled. Electric vehicles. There was a similar dynamic. The amount of innovation that has been stifled because it threatens existing markets for corporations, I think, I mean, somebody should be, I mean, I imagine there are books on this. If you know of a book about that, tell us. But I mean, this is just
Killing
a dynamic
the Future by Bill O'Reilly.
Exactly.
Killing
but this
our
is,
who
this
killed
is an
the planet
ongoing dynamic.
By Bill O'Reilly.
Yep. Hi, this is Rory. I'm calling with a libertarian perspective about that. And I'm wondering if maybe if you went to the company, I don't know, you say that they stopped the electric car. I don't know the history. I can't really hear it too well. But maybe if you went to the car companies and you said, hey, man, let's do some nonviolent communication together. And maybe you don't kill the electric car. And then that way there wouldn't be force. Did you ever think of doing that?
Yes, I did think about it. It didn't work.
Oh, so you, could you give me the evidence that it didn't work? Because I thought we were having an evidence-based conversation.
Well, this is just so, like, tragically accurate that it's not even a comedy bit. It's
no,
really
this is, I don't think freedom's a joke at all.
All right. We're going to take a break, head into the fun half. When we come back, we'll take your IMs. We'll attempt to take maybe some calls, and we'll do some sound. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. You can support this program by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you support the free show, and then as a way of saying thank you, we give you access to the fun half. And as always, if you do not have the means to become a member, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com and wait and wait and wait. And then eventually we will get through all those emails and hook you up. Today is Friday, which means that tomorrow is Saturday. And then Sunday, and then Monday, and then Tuesday, and then what happens on Tuesday, Michael?
Well, it's funny you say that, because what happens on Tuesday is Richard Wolff returns, but we're actually doing a Sunday TMBS because we're off the following week. And Adoma Kachiechu is going to join us to talk about her new book on the making of the Third World Project and what undid it. And also Derek Davidson will stop by. We'll be live at 7 p.m. on the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. Of course, patreon.com/TMBS for the whole thing, but we're starting either at 6 or 7. I'm sorry. I'm not sure yet. I'll tweet that information out.
You and Jamie got to work that out, right, Jamie? Because what's happening on the Intifada this week?
Wait, actually, before we do that, there's two other things that I promised to plug. Teacher Lauren has asked me to say tomorrow at between 11 and 4 in Poughkeepsie, there'll be a parking lot of the Exempt Firemen's Association at 200 Mason Street. And there's an event on the Poughkeepsie DSA Facebook page, and it's Mid-Hudson DSA, if anyone is interested. And also, of course, tickets to the TMBS LA Live show. And the Brazil Wire has put out a new book called The Year of Lead, which I wrote the foreword to, and find a link to it on the homepage as well. Please support Brazil Wire and grab that book.
Jamie.
This week on the Antifada, in our free episode on Wednesday, we spoke with Brett and Brian, the chill anarchist dads from Street Fight Radio, about anarchism, organizing, parenting, drugs, and more. And today, for our patrons, we also released a bonus ep that we did with Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session. So check that out if you want to hear my vulgar Marxist take on the movie Us. Sean's vulgar Hegelian take on the movie Us, and Leslie Lee III's educated take on what the movie was actually about. So check it out, folks.
Matt.
Yeah, Literary Hangover did the Oscar Wilde, The Soul of Man Under Socialism. If you want to hear Oscar Wilde talk about socialism, check that out.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half, and take a quick break and head into the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back.